Go. So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is an easy day to remember, January 1st, 2014. And I want to continue this series of talks I've been doing on the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths with a bit of a twist that's relevant to this new year. And as you probably know or heard others say or me say, the Buddha essentially said there are four things that are really true and really important. One is the truth of suffering, both subtle and intense. Second, the truth of the cause of that suffering, which in his model, at bottom, was a kind of craving, a sense of deficit or disturbance that leads us to go to war with what's unpleasant or flee from it, that leads us to grasp after what's pleasant and leads us to cling to what's heartfelt. That's the second noble truth. The third noble truth is the one I want to focus on tonight, which is the truth of the possibility of the end of all that mishigas, all that crud, all that crud. That's the third noble truth of the ending of the cause of suffering and therefore the suffering that it causes. And then the fourth noble truth is the path that is both an expression of the gradual reduction of the causes of suffering and the path that is a support for the gradual reduction of the causes of suffering. So in terms of the third noble truth, my focus tonight, the frame of the Buddha in saying it was basically the good news. And without trying to do that kind of reductionism between traditions or between religions that actually can go too far, if you think about the original meaning of the Gospels as the good news, in some way the Buddha is also saying the good news in the third noble truth, that suffering can really end. In the language that we've been using here, there will be pain. There will be physical pain and discomfort. There will be social or emotional pain or discomfort that the flesh is the heir to. There's no way out of a certain amount of pain in this life as an inherent aspect of animal and human existence. But the third noble truth is this good news that there need not be suffering. There need not be those additional self-inflicted pains and wounds that we add to the inherent inescapable pain of living altogether. It's not that living, of course, is only pain. It's that there is pain and there has been pain and there will be pain. That's certainly been true for me, I suspect for others, but there need not be suffering. So that's good news. Okay. So it's in that frame of celebration, really. The Buddha was known as the happy one, that we're considering this third noble truth as it might be relevant to this coming year. So what is the nature of this possibility of the end of suffering? Is it something we have to train and make ourselves into, sculpt ourselves into, scratch and claw our way into being? No. It's actually a falling away of whatever is in the way of our own natural happiness, our own natural radiant wakefulness, our natural contribution, our naturally loving heart. As they say in Tibet, practice is really a gradual process of the removal of the obscurations. In other words, rather than scratching and clawing our way up to the top of the mountain, we hang out and we help the mists of ignorance and confusion and neuroticism and me, myself, and I and all the rest of that, we help those mists gradually dispel through our wisdom and concentration, through our restraint and virtue, and through our wisdom. We help those mists dispel, and we gradually realize that we've been hanging out all along in this beautiful, lovely meadow with lots of wonderful other creatures and other good-hearted people. That's pretty good news. That's the fundamental structure, and that's why so much of Buddhism, particularly the admonition parts of it, the instructional parts of it, are expressed in the negative. Do not kill. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not abuse yourself and others through sexuality or intoxication. Those are expressed in the negative. It's as if we don't crave. That's the definition, really, of the third noble truth. It's the absence of the negative force. the moral stance in Buddhism is not entirely, but it's a lot about the absence of the negatives, because when there's the absence of the negatives, our true nature shines forth. That's pretty cool. So that's the structure of the Third Noble Truth. How do we accomplish that, in essence? And I want to link here to my main topic tonight, which is intention and wise intention and your own wise intentions for this coming year. Well, the essence of intention, and intention is seen as fundamental in the Buddhist structure. One of the major innovations of Buddhism, distinct from the Vedic teachings of the Buddhist time, was that mechanical acts alone did not count. It was about the intention behind them, which made practice very psychological and less ritualistic. It brought it into the psyche of the individual person and the intentions of the person. What's in the heart? What's the inclination of the person? That's what really has the most karma. That's what has the most effect on us and on others. Okay. So in the Buddhist frame, the central intention summarized under the heading of the wise intention or right intention element of the Noble Eightfold Path, there are three fundamental intentions. The first intention is non-harming. We don't harm ourselves, we don't harm other people, in ways large and small. The second intention is sometimes expressed as the intention of renunciation. Maybe another way to express that intention would be non-grasping. Again, the Buddha's innovation was not to deny the body or to go to war with the body or the body's natural interests and ordinary pleasures. And the Buddha's own stance was that there are many forms of wholesome wanting, wholesome desire, wholesome aspiration, wholesome wishes, such as loving kindness for others, or wanting to awaken oneself, but not tipping into a kind of clinging to or craving for or essentializing or grasping onto inherently passing experiences. So that's the second major intention, renunciation. We don't chase the rewards. Okay? The first intention being we don't harm. We don't go to war with what's unpleasant. And the third main intention, under the heading of wise intention, is the intention of no ill will. Very interesting. The Buddha, as he does in so many ways, brings it into relationships. We try to help ourselves drop ill will. You know, the opposite of ill will is goodwill. We try to drop ill will toward others. Ill will shows up in lots and lots of ways. Little forms of domination, not always so little. Bearing grudges, waging campaigns, if only in one's own mind, you know, that muttering case about those other people, those conversations, we keep looping, the pounding of the points home, you know, the basically thinking of others, thinking of Martin Buber's structure of relationships in basically three kinds of relationships, I, thou, I, it, and it, turning others into its is a kind of ill will. So we have there, built into wise intention, a kind of structure that I've talked about in here before that is linked to the three fundamental needs of any animal, including a human animal, three fundamental needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, loosely related to the reptile, mammal, and primate-human stages of evolution. And we have here in wise intention the intention not to tip into trouble in terms of avoiding harms, by harming others. And we have here the intention not to get into trouble in terms of approaching rewards by grasping after other things. And instead, we help ourselves renounce that. We become increasingly at peace amidst this world of wonders. And we have also in wise intention the expression of, you know, not getting into trouble also in terms of our needs to attach to others through ill will. Also, in terms of these fundamental intentions, we both manifest these intentions and we express these intentions in more concrete ways through the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path is kind of structured into three parts, which has to do with the three fundamental pillars of Buddhist practice. So we both support our good intentions, our right intentions, and we also express our good intentions, our right intentions, our wise intentions through sila, the Pali word for virtue or restraint, morality, ethical conduct, balance of body and mind. We support and express our intentions through samadhi, which is the pillar of practice that's about concentration, the training of attention, non-ordinary states of awareness, and mindfulness altogether. And last, we support and express our intentions through punya, the Pali word for wisdom, insight, in ways large and small. So as we cultivate sila, samadhi, and punya, it's easier and easier to naturally manifest and live from the good intentions to not harm and to not grasp and to not have ill will for other people. And as we progressively get more and more at ease and more, if you will, centered in the green zone and not caught up in harming or grasping or ill will, that supports our virtue, that supports our concentration, and that supports our wisdom. Those are the essential intentions, I think, in Buddhist practice. So I wanted to bring it into this year. And we have time. Good. So in a moment, I'll suggest we do a little thing that you don't have to do, like anything in here. Okay? And the little thing is that you find a partner in a moment, and once you're settled with your partner, and you can always sit this out if you want, I'll take you through a little 2-minute or so guided practice about your intentions for the coming year, especially intentions related to practice, and then give you an opportunity to talk back and forth with a partner about that as openly as you want. And then we'll come back together and talk about this. Okay? But before I go any further, I just want to see if you have any. That was a very fast summary of a lot of Dharma with some major headlines. Any questions or comments about anything I've said so far? Great. How about first you, then you, then we'll go on. Yeah.
I'm just new to this. So
great.
I mean, to the Buddhist practice, I just didn't get a thing, and I just didn't understand it. Maybe.
Sure.
Because I hadn't heard it before.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been here before, but to work with someone, I don't think I grasped enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, honestly. You know, there's this famous saying, beginner's mind, Zen mind. So it's good to have beginner's mind, right? It's great. And so I'll just kind of quick recap, right? So we have these four noble truths, right? And the third one is the truth that we can end the craving that makes us suffer and also causes suffering. How do we do that? Well, we can't just lollygag it around. We've got to have intention, right? We've got to take responsibility. We've got to make it real for ourselves, you know, right? So what are those intentions? What are the intentions that have the most power? What are the intentions that free us from the puppet master of craving that's pulling our strings all day long? What is it that does that? The Buddha taught that there are three key intentions. One intention is you don't hurt other people or yourself or the planet. You don't harm with acts of, you know, thought, word, and deed. That's pretty clear. I get that one, right? Second, main intention that frees us from the shackles of craving is to lighten up about pleasure. Not get so caught up in it. Don't chase it so much. You know what I mean? Don't get so driven around it. Watch out for that sense of pressure inside. You know, watch out when we're, you know, chasing after stuff and paying a bigger and bigger price for it, right? That's pretty clear, you know? Live moderately, you know? Just, enjoy pleasure without trying to hold on to it. That makes sense. And then the third key intention, in terms of freeing ourselves from craving and, you know, getting caught up in that like neurotic mind, is to also be benevolent toward others and don't have ill will for them. Right? Don't look down on others. Don't think you're better than them. Don't, don't do those things we tend to do and easily in ways large and small, to be aggressive toward others or mistreat others. Don't do that. You know, that'll free you as well from getting caught up in craving. That's good. Yep. And then one way to help yourself have these intentions is develop greater and greater virtue. Because the more virtuous a person is, not in some uptight, moralistic, sort of way, but more from an inside-out kind of way, is, you know, we're kind of more at ease and at peace in the world. We don't get so caught up in, hurting other people or being mean to them or getting addictive to various things, right? Virtue. So there's that pillar of practice, sila, in the traditional word. Then there's the element of training the mind so you're in the moment, so you're awake. I mean, how in the world can we pursue our intentions if we're kind of asleep, you know, or driving like that? We can't do that. So that's where mindfulness comes in, that's where meditation comes in, training the mind, and also deepening in concentration so we experience more and more happiness and bliss, frankly, not based on worldly events, but we've cultivated inside ourselves through training and concentration. Okay? That's the samadhi element of practice. That makes sense. Okay? So live right, train your mind, and third pillar of practice, the wisdom pillar, panya in Pali, is as you live right and train your mind, see more and more clearly. Cultivate wisdom. See the truth of things as you see it for yourself. You know. Get wiser in the process. All right? That's a good path. It's down to earth. It's really psychological. I'll repeat it again and again.
Thank you.
Yeah, but that's good. You know, and you can see those three elements, those three pillars of practice, basic virtue, basic mindfulness, and basic wisdom. You can see them in other traditions as well. I have a friend who's a professor of Christian contemplative practice, speaking of being in a Christian temple of sorts here. And some of the language is almost identical, mindfulness, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom. Okay? All right, great. And one key point about all that is that, again, in this uncovering process, remember, we're uncovering what the wonderful truth that's always already the case. In Buddhism, it's sometimes called our Buddha nature. And there are kind of three ways to understand your own Buddha nature. One way is, what's it like to be in any moment when your mind is not clouded by harming others or grasping after pleasure or ill will? What's it like in the moment when you're not, you know, fighting pain or chasing pleasure or clutching to others? You know, that's our home base. That's Buddha nature right there. In that moment, there's little, if any, craving. That's our home base. It's our resting state. We're still in the world. We're still engaging things. We're still having fun. We're still speaking truth to power, trying to make the world a better place, but without a mind clouded by confusion or grasping. The deeper kind of Buddha nature is an opening into allness, is a sense of oneness or connectedness with everything, and a relaxing the contracted sense of self. And so that kind of Buddha nature is the nature of allness. What's its nature? And we become increasingly identified with the nature of allness because, of course, that's our nature as well. This starts out as often more of a conceptual understanding, this kind of Buddha nature. On the other hand, many times people have powerful intuitions of it, which they then spend years understanding. Both go together, it's fine. But that's a deeper, more fundamental kind of Buddha nature. And then ultimately, it is said or implied that in some ways, Buddha nature partakes of something actually transcendental that the Buddha said is beyond words, that's encountered in nirvana, or that we can have some sense of in everyday life with a feeling for, if you will, unconditionality that's always present just before conditionality congeals in the moment. And again, that can be conceptual, but increasingly there might be some kind of intuition of it, or a sense of being increasingly foamy or transparent to that unconditionality, which has a profound freedom in it, because it's prior to the congealing and stabilizing of forms. One nice thing to appreciate is the Buddha's teaching is that you always had Buddha nature. You don't gain Buddha nature, you uncover it. And one of the most beautiful expressions of non-harming and renunciation and dropping ill will is to see Buddha nature in other people, is to see the suffering in other people, to see the ordinary and wonderful human qualities of mind and heart in other people, and also to see their Buddha nature, to look at them, especially if they're aggravating you. That's when it's really hard. And to see that they too, like you, have Buddha nature, in some way are Buddha nature, are of the nature of a Buddha. So let's talk about how to intend this and manifest this in the coming year, okay? And I'll happily talk to you maybe when we end tonight, okay? So if you'd like, we'll do this kind of quickly. Find a partner, or you can sit this out. So identify who your partner is and spread out if you like. And with your partner, you'll be talking a little bit about how to manifest this year. If you want a partner and don't have one, raise your hand. There you are, Tressa, see her? Look around, see people with a hand up. Everybody have a partner who wants one? Yeah. I'll give more instructions. Do you want a partner? Anybody else want a partner? Partner? Oh, well. Okay, good. Okay, listen up, please. So here's a little reflection. Oh, before you do this, with your partner, pick an A and a B. A's will talk first, B's will mainly listen, then you'll switch roles, I'll give a time signal. It'll be about 3 to 5 minutes each way. Okay? So pick an A and a B inside your little pair. A's will talk first, all right? And again, B's mostly listen, give A's room. Okay, so here's the quiet reflection. All right, take a moment. Your eyes open or closed, kind of coming into your own body, into this moment. And then take a moment to open to what your heart really longs for. Especially related to deep or fundamental matters. It could be what your heart really longs for in your ordinary life. Maybe a shift in your work or a different kind of relationship or a relationship altogether. Or more truer ways to express your own contributions. And also see what your heart really longs for in the deeper matters of your own relationship to your mind and what your heart longs for in terms of practice, your own practice, and your own awakening, your own uncovering of Buddha nature in yourself. What does your heart long for? you'll find that longing that's honest and deep and is not agitated, but is really true. Being in touch with that longing, related to suffering and awakening and Buddha nature, lightly look out over the 12 months ahead, kind of lightly observing it, maybe like from a bird's eye view, 10,000 feet above the year, and see what comes to you in terms of just kind of keys or wisdom about honoring your longing of the heart. What would that look like in everyday life? Perhaps there's simply one key thing that comes to mind that's important to make sanctuary for in your life, or tend to. There might be a handle of kind of implementations of this longing you have, or ways to support it, to stand up for it, without getting into complication about it, kind of intuitive. What comes to you? And last, see if you can imagine yourself kind of moving through the year, manifesting support for your longings of the heart and being successful in realistic ways about them, and imagining here and now wholesome rewards coming to you and others from being true to the longings in your heart, supporting them and being successful with them. Imagining the year unfolding in the way that your heart longs for. Come on back. And in a moment, if you can keep your voices down too, it'll be easier for all of us. In a moment, A's, you can share with your partner whatever you'd like to share about what your reflections were just now, or anything else you'd like to say about the year to come. And as a bit of a framework for that, something that might be useful to you, it's been useful for me, is to think of the ways in which the Buddha talked about setting intentions or New Year's resolutions or resolutions of any kind. He used the language of, I undertake the training precept to. Think of that language. I undertake the training precept. I'm training myself by doing this. it's not a moralistic commandment. And there's a recognition, you know, I may not always do it. All right? But I undertake this as a practice to gradually train my mind, like guiding a horse and training a horse over time. That might be a lighter way to hold intentions, knowing that you may not be perfect about them, but you can still be sincere in the intention. Okay? So A's, take it away. How about 3 minutes or so? And then I'll give you a little signal to switch roles. Okay, A's, please begin. One more minute, A's. Okay, wrap it up, A's. And switch roles. B's, your turn to talk. A's, turn to listen. Begin. One more minute. Wrap it up. Okay, come on back. All right. As usual, I'm going a little long. Sorry about that. One or a few people, comments or questions? Great. Out of doing that, yeah.
The difference between craving and longing.
Right. That's your question in a way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think of, great question. In the Buddhist languaging, craving is driven by thirst. It's based on a sense of deficit or disturbance. Whereas there are wholesome desires, right? Which I'm using the word longings for, including, I think for most people, deep down inside, there's a felt sense that their mind is doing something that's making themselves suffer and other people. The mind is contracting or driving or grabbing or creating a me. We sense that, and there's some wish, to just drop it, to let it go. It's like, what does it feel like to hold the hand in a fist? You know, after a while, what's your longing? Hold your hand in a tight fist, and what's your longing at that point?
Letting go.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. And I think one of the marks of our Buddha nature is we have an intuition of this freedom and this peace and this contentment and love that's really possible because we have it's native to us. It's part of our nature, right? And we're inclined in that direction. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Anybody else? Comment, question? Anything come to you about looking to the new year? Oh, good, good. Right. If I get you right, my experience is, and I think others would say that, as we set our intentions, there is, especially around certain kinds of sila, certain kinds of virtue or restraint, there can be a kind of friction or fire between our habit patterns and our wholesome intent to stop doing that or start doing the other thing. So it's understood that there can be discomfort, you know. But 2 points. We don't need to be disturbed by the disturbance moving through us. That's really key, you know. It can feel disturbing to interrupt the habit of eating or drinking or smoking or doing one way or another. Or it could feel disturbing to adopt a discipline of getting up earlier or exercising or writing or whatever. But we don't need to be disturbed by that. Disturbance moving through us, if that makes sense, which is kind of cool. And then the other thing I would say, quoting Ajahn Chah, his major teacher in the lineage of Spirit Rock and so forth, he said basically there are 2 kinds of suffering. There's the suffering that leads to more suffering, and the suffering that leads to less suffering. And he said, if you don't do more of the latter, you will surely have more of the former. And like so many things he says, it just cuts right to the heart of things. That's what I think. There's the suffering that frees us and the suffering that chains us. And pick your poison. Yeah, I'm kind of like that. Yeah. And I think in that last thing, and I really should end on this one, I'll stick around for a bit afterward, is to honor yourself for your practice. You know, that's really important. It takes guts, it takes gumption, it takes stick-to-itiveness, it takes grit to keep practicing. It does go against the stream in many ways of modern culture. In some ways, practice goes against the stream of evolution. You know, our animal ancestors who had to crave and suffer in order to pass on genes that passed on genes. So honor yourself, and that'll keep you motivated, and respect practice and others, and cultivate sanctuary for practice, and especially when practice is hard. Some aspects of practice are really sweet. Opening to Buddha nature is pretty sweet, right? Opening to bliss or joy as a factor of concentration, that's pretty sweet. But there are aspects of practice that are more uncomfortable, and especially when the rhythm of practice is increasing the discomfort factor, at those times especially, I think it's good to really honor yourself. How about we sit and just kind of hang out and just kind of imagine that your year is unfolding in a way that's alignment, in alignment with your own Buddha nature. May you and all beings have a truly happy new year. See you next week.